Hello and welcome to today's online event hosted by the International Inequalities Institute at LSE. My name is Dr. George Kunath and I am research fellow at the LSE International Inequalities Institute. I'm incredibly pleased to be chairing today's event titled Going to My Father's House, A History of My Times. This event launches historian Patrick Joyce's book of the same name and will comprise a discussion between the author and discussants Catherine Hall and Madeline Bunting. Patrick Joyce is Emeritus Professor of History, University of Manchester. He's a leading British social historian and has written and edited numerous books of social and political history, including Visions of the People, The Oxford Reader on Class, The Rule of Freedom, and The State of Freedom. He's currently writing a new book, Remembering Peasants, which will be out in 2022 or in early 2023. Professor Catherine Hall is Emerita Professor of Modern British Social and Cultural History at University College London. And Madeline Bunting is an award-winning author and visiting professor in practice at the LSE International Inequalities Institute. This event will run for around 1.5 hours, starting from now, 12:30 to 2 p.m. Our panel will present for around an hour. And as usual, there will be the chance for our audience to pose questions in the final 30 minutes. Please do so by utilizing the Q&A box at the bottom of your screens, stating your name and affiliation where possible. So the next public event to be held at the III will be Changing the Story of Disability on Monday, 11th October. Details and registration link, along with the further information about upcoming events at the III can be found in the chat. Now I will hand over the mic to our speaker, Professor Patrick Joyce. Many thanks to everybody, and I really hope you enjoy the event. Patrick, please.
Thank you. Thank you, George. Hello to everybody out there. I'm going to start by reading a small section, or not so small section, of the introduction. And then hopefully I have a little bit of time just to go through the contents very briefly. And hopefully I will stick to my 15 minutes, so I'm sure I'll be told if I don't, so I'll put my watch down here anyway. So I'll start reading from the beginning of the introduction, and let me start with the epigraph for the whole book, which is from the Irish poet John Montagu's The Severed Head, which comes from a longer poem, The Rough Field. Decades later, that child's grandchild's speech stumbles over lost syllables of an old order. The introduction begins with another epigraph from the great German romantic poet Novalis. I am always going to my father's house. I am always going home. This book began as a history of my parents, written for my children. It was in this regard personal but also universal. For in my act of writing, I joined hands with how most of humanity apprehends the past, namely through the family that has gone and is to come. The time that is most presently and intimately the past and the hopeful future is the time of the family. It is as if the family is the door which is the one most open to us, the one from which the light of the past shines brightest. As in many such acts of remembrance, my aim was to take the existence of my parents out of the historical obscurity from which they came, for they were poor and without a voice. They were immigrants from an island that now seems centuries, not decades ago. What I began to write was a bequest to the future, so that their lives were not forgotten and would be part of possible futures, if only those of my grandchildren. I thought that my posterity in this time of great change might even, in the relatively short period between my writing and their reading, be already too far hurled into the future to make sense of their own lives without knowing more of the worlds from which they came. What I wrote, I also considered to be something of a homage to my parents. I can find no better word, homage, because of the debt I owe them, which was the life they made for me and my brother in London and the Irishness they gave us. That dual debt of gratitude for that which was made in the new place and that which was carried from the old one is one that immigrant children from everywhere always have. So in discharging this debt, I found that I was also telling a bigger story, one of the immigrant and their children. Homage involves the show of public respect. And as I wrote, I realized I wanted to mark their lives more widely than my family alone. And so the historical details started to accrue. I am by occupation and preoccupation as a historian, so that the banking up of historical details is second nature to me. My way forward has much in common with that of Czesław Miłosz in his native realm, this book called Native Realm, published first in 1859. Though our books are very different in many other respects, and he is a man of my father's generation, only a year separating them. The introduction to his book, which he subtitles The Search for Self-Definition, concludes with words whose simple eloquence I borrow now. The vision of the small patch on the globe to which I owe everything suggests where I should draw the line. A three-year-old's love for his aunt or jealousy towards his father take up so much room in autobiographical writing because everything else, for instance, a history of a country or a national group, is treated as something normal and therefore of little interest to the narrator. But another method is possible. Instead of thrusting the individual into the foreground, one can focus attention on the background, looking upon oneself as a sociological phenomenon. Inner experience, as it is preserved in the memory, will then be evaluated in the perspective of the changes one's milieu has undergone. The passing over of certain periods important for oneself, but requiring too personal an explanation, will be a token of respect for those undergrounds that exist in all of us and are better left in peace. Yet one can avoid the dryness of a scholarly treatise because the outside world will be coloured by memory and subjective judgment. I continue in my own words. I have been a witness to three epochal historical transformations: the end of the old peasant order, the passage from World War to peace, and the decline of the old manual working class. Yet, as I've been witness to other epochal changes as well, but these are the ones that are probably epochal enough. Anyway, that's not from the text. Yet, as the work developed, and as the historical circles widened, I needed to keep history and memory together, and so find things that resonated with both and made listening to the silences of time easier. I needed things both solid and symbolic, things that speak widely. I found these in three figures: the house, the road, and the grave. These are real, the house and not just the home, the road and not just traveling, real and not only figurative graves. that of my parents in Irish and Catholic West London, for instance, in Kensal Green Cemetery, which I write about in the book. At the same time, what could be symbolically more rich than these three figures? Indeed, they seem almost overloaded with significance. Age-old as they are, their richness extending across many cultures. The house, the road, and the grave, stability, movement, and separation, the ending, that is death. Other things too, of course, are represented by these three. The house, confining as well as nurturing, roads taken and not taken, the grave a beginning rather than only an ending. I write about another real thing also, walls, those of houses but also of cities, the city of Derry, for instance, walls in the head too. I take my first bearings in my father's house in Joyce country in the Galway and Mayo of North Connemara. Joyce country, mapped as such by the 18th century, is Duce Shuia in Irish. The critic Patrick Sheehan has used the road, the house and the grave to triangulate what he calls Galway space. This is the space of literature, an imaginary space for sure, but one rooted in real things, in houses, roads and graves. From these it draws all its strength. It could have been my mother's house I chose in Wexford, in Ireland's southeast, a place somewhat more benign than the once impoverished West. That was the house of my remembered childhood, the one in Wexford, but the first house I was taken to was my father's house in 1949. He died relatively young, when I was young. My mother lived longer, so it was to his house I went to find him after his death, and I've sought him ever since. So I'll just conclude by reading a little bit further before I get, if I have time, to run through the contents. This is a section which summarizes, it's from the introduction, it kind of summarizes the book. The first section is called Beginnings, and is concerned with the sense of place. And the place that lingers most is the house of childhood. This is what shapes the sense of place most as life goes by, for good and ill, for the house may itself be a good house or a bad one. It need not be the first house either. But if not, it is usually some house, a place where childhood was, where we leave behind a past that we forever carry with us. As I wrote the book, I realized that my parents' experience of war was intrinsic to who they were, and thus to who I became. Thinking about my father, who was wounded in the bombing in Portsmouth in 1941, I was led into thinking that war was a matter of the silences as much as the noise of my generation. This war, the silences and the noise, has long continued to reverberate. Silence was the price of the noise, the silence of my father and so many like him, the silences that bolstered the nostalgic idea of the Second World War and of the nation that followed it, and that have done so much damage in Britain. I came upon another silence as I went along, one that echoed powerfully for me. The truly forgotten are the bombed civilian dead of the other side, the German dead, the children especially. For I was then as they were, a child, if only in the womb, that of a war worker who made the aeroplanes that caused this vengeful annihilation. My subject in the second section is war, therefore. So I cannot exclude what went on in the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland, which was in all truth a war too, one that has made Britain and has so often threatened to break it. So I went to Derry and its walls to find what this war was and where it had come from. North and South are natural contrasts in England, part of the history. My life has been divided into two halves, both temporally and geographically, the first in London, the second in the industrial North. So in the third section titled North, I'm concerned with the destruction of a whole way of life, one that had lasted a century and a half by the time I came upon it in the 1970s, right at the moment of its ending, the fall of industrial Jerusalem, as I entitled one of the chapters. My subjects are what this old industrial way of life was and what it has become, the uprooting of a way of life and a unique way of dwelling. These consequences concern what it is to dwell peacefully in the state that is the United Kingdom and the nation that is England, to dwell peacefully in a kingdom torn apart by an argument that is also about dwelling, the argument about Brexit. Okay, I'll leave it there because time is going on. The book was written in the kind of shadow of Brexit, or the last section was. So very briefly, I'll run through the chapters. And the first section is called Beginnings. It's four chapters like all the three sections. The first is called The Journey West, and it's about my going to Ireland, my encounter with the work that I found there, the life I found there, particularly in the West, but in Wexford too. The second chapter is called The Journey East, and it's about my parents' move from Ireland, their move into London in the very, very early, in 1929, my father went to England as an itinerant labourer, my mother after him in the 1930s. I described there the life they made for us in London, the transposition of the Irish idea of home to the English setting, transposition as best they could make. The third chapter is called Time Thickens, Takes on Flesh, and the quotation is from Bakhtin. And it's subtitled The Other West, and that's an attempt to describe the world in which I grew up, in not just Irish London, but in the London that surrounded us, although Irish London defines so much of that experience. The fourth and the last chapter in that section is called Other Houses. And I grew up in Paddington, Notting Hill in West London. I went to school during the riots of 1958. First that were going on. And I draw on the work of an American sociologist, wonderful work, but this is an extraordinary knack to talk to children and to adults. And he brings out from the testimony of people who lived in an estate in South London, a sense of the house itself and the significance of the home, and of homes lost and homes hoped for, houses vacated, new houses entered, which I found terribly, myself very moving and spoke to me directly. The second section is called War, and it deals first of all with, it's called, the first chapter is called The Death of Miles Joyce, and it's briefly, very briefly, it's about the wrongful execution and the wrongful imprisonment of a number of members of the Joyce family in the area, in my father's area, in Joyce country, which became a cause célèbre at the time. And it's a way of getting into the question of what history, what responsibility history carries, if any. I quote the effect of the German past as well. How the past is something that we can't just pick and choose, it's given to us. Just as I think our identities are, to some extent we can choose them, but I tend to think, being a kind of congenital cultural Catholic, that our identities are not what we choose. We don't choose our identities choose us, is how I put it, I think. Anyway, cultural Catholicism aside, which means a lot, and it's a very important kind of influence in the book. I continue to believe in the God I don't believe in, I suppose. And the last chapter is about Derry, and it's about the war, and it's about my interest in actual material things. I'm interested in real houses, the houses of the awful slums of West London. the graves, my parents' grave in Kensal Green Cemetery, the Catholic Cemetery of St Mary's in West London. It's also, it's about the graves of those who were destroyed in the bombing in the Second World War. I look at the town of Darmstadt, for instance. I'm backtracking to the Warsaw. Darmstadt, which was bombed on the night by my imagined conception, a literary conceit, but there we are. It was a way of trying to sort of link myself, but I found myself linked anyway to that destruction. Anyway, the walls of Derry and the physical nature of the walls, and my own connection to Northern Ireland through my wife, who was I'm at an age where if I try to think of something, it goes straight out of my head. But anyway, born in the north and grew up to the sound of the orange drum in the background of the one day in the year when the neighbours turned nasty. They were all right for the rest of the year, and then because solidarity had to be shown. Anyway, onto the north, and finally, the world that was, as it were, industrial Jerusalem is my chapter 9. And then what happened to Manchester especially, and again I come back to roads, and I was interested in the first section I write about the road I walked as a child, the worst slums in London.
Patrick, we can't hear you.
Okay, I'm going to just introduce him after the fall, and then a meditation about home, and then a return to London. The last chapter is called Ending. I return to what was left, what is left of the Irish community in London, still a considerable one. But it's also points the way to the new book about peasants, because it ends on the note of returning to Ireland as well as to a new kind of Ireland as well as to London. Okay, well, thanks for the time, and sorry if I overshot.
No, you are perfectly in time. No worries at all. Now may I invite Catherine to speak, please?
Hello, everyone, and thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation with Patrick and Madeline and George and anybody else who we hope is going to join it around the subject of Patrick's book, which I think he's given you a good introduction to. I hope I've been getting terrible noises. Have they now stopped? I'm hoping they have.
Yeah, no, it's perfect now. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Good. All right. So, well, this is a book which has given me much food for thought, and which I've have all kinds of connected and unconnected thoughts about it. And I mean, from a personal point of view, I'm of the same generation as Patrick. I've known him for many years. We're both historians. He's written in connected but different ways to the ways in which I've written. My mother was cremated in Kensal Green in the Protestant part of the cemetery that he describes in some very moving details in the book. I've moved from north to south rather than from south to north. So having grown up in Leeds, I've watched the destruction of the industrial working class from the perspective of London. And having lived with a Jamaican for many, many years, I've experienced exile through others. But I have no claims to anything other than Englishness myself. Anyway, I have a question for Patrick and a couple of comments. So my question is that I'd like him to talk a bit more about the relation between history and memory. And he describes the book as between memoir and history. And I'd like him to talk a bit about the move he has made from writing mostly about the 19th century, about the state, about liberalism, about the social, about class, about the textile industry, all those things that he, about governmentality, all those things that he wrote about for so many years. And this shift to writing in this much more personal way in the later part of his life. And then to the book that he's now writing on the peasantry, which obviously I can see many connections with the book that we've read because of the work on Ireland. But I gather that the book on the peasantry is, anyway, it would be good to hear some more about that. So I just wanted to make two points really. Two thoughts that come from the book. And the first is about living with the dead, which of course as historians, we all do, and as human beings, we all do. It's impossible not to live with the dead, whether it's our parents or people we know, or, and of course, as we get older, we all live with many more dead people. But having been a historian all my working life, I've also been living with the dead who I've never known for decades. Well, writing history is, of course, a form of memory work. And I was struck by the connections in Patrick's book with Sebald, who has obviously been a tremendous influence on him. I was very shocked when I read a long review a few weeks ago. I love Sebald's writing, and actually I've just reread Austerlitz, which is such a remarkable novel. But I was rather shocked when I read a most interesting review of the new biography, which has been written of Sebald, which explains that Sebald, the apparent memory work, much of it is in fact fictionalized. Much of it is put together from different sources of different people, so that the picture that we get in the book is really quite misleading. And obviously Sebald knew exactly what he was doing. But anyway, it's quite interesting thinking about that. He also produced the photographs, he manipulated the photographs that he used. So the whole sense that we get in his writing of dwelling with these particular dead people is obviously something rather particular to his style of writing, and not I think what Patrick's doing. But it raises those questions about memory, false memory, you know, what do we actually remember, and what have we produced as narratives in order to explain our own lives and situate ourselves through narrative in the past. And I'm sure everyone here will have had the experience of saying to some old friend, you know, don't you remember when? And they say, no, it wasn't like that at all. You know, that's completely different from how I remember it. So the problem of memory in relation to history writing. And then I think it's really interesting to think about why family histories and memoirs have become such an incredibly important form in the late 21st, early 21st century. I mean, it is very, very striking how many people are writing in this way. And of course, family history is just extraordinarily popular. And I mean, just to give you an example, the database that we have created at UCL on the slave owners and their families, 2 million people have now gone to that database, and most of them are doing it for reasons of genealogy. They want to know about lost pasts. And in the case of course, of the descendants of enslaved people, this is a particularly difficult problem. It connects to many of the issues that Patrick raises, the need for a place, the need for a sense of origin, the longing for a lineage and the longing for ancestors in times of extraordinary mobility. But one of the, and the desire to repopulate the past with figures who in some sense we feel that we know, though of course we don't know, because what we get is fragments which we have to produce and narrativized as our picture of who those people are. When you think about slavery particularly, it brings up such problems about family history and memory. Because, I mean, for example, there are no graves. Patrick talks about the importance of the grave, which I completely understand and sympathize with, how vital it is to have a place that you can go to, a place that where the memories can be lived with, where the dead can be lived with. But for the descendants of enslaved people, of course, there were no graves. And one of the interesting things that's happening now is the search for the lost burial grounds, both in the United States and in the Caribbean, to try and locate people who it's very, very hard to locate, and you can only locate through fragments when what you want to do is giving ancestors names, recognition, and proper burials. So in accumulating the fragments, of course, what we're trying to do is to understand the patterns of lives from the past. And as Alison Light reminds us in her lovely book, Common People, looking for family histories is the most popular search on the internet after looking for pornography. So that gives you an indication of the scale on which it's happening, and it's ever growing, ever growing, ever growing. So it's something very particular about now. And Patrick at one point talks about it in relation to the problem of thinking about it as a form of narcissism, that what we're looking for is ourselves rather than for the dead. But of course, as Freud reminds us, narcissism is very, very essential to life and survival, though we all hate the excesses of it but I do hate the excesses of it that I see in our contemporary world and our contemporary politics. Just one other point about this living with the dead. Patrick's book has been connecting with so many other books for me, which I think is because it's alive in my mind, which is a wonderful thing for a book to be. And I've never read any of David Grossman's books before, but I've just read A Horse Comes Into a Bar, which is the most extraordinary book about the return to childhood at the end of a life. And of course, that is such a common human pattern, that as people get older, they go back into the more distant past, which has a kind of urgency as you reach towards the end of your life, which you didn't have before. And my late husband's own book between memoir and history, Familiar Stranger, was very much out of the preoccupations of his return to his Jamaican childhood. In the last years of his life. So then I wanted to raise another related question, which is about remembering, forgetting, and reparation. Because again, such a big question for Ireland, but also a big question for the Caribbean, which is my particular area of work and concern. So Patrick notes that forgetting is much more difficult in Ireland than it is in Britain. And that he comments rather tartly and correctly that the British make a specialism of forgetting. But of course, as Renan pointed out, we all know that forgetting is an active thing. You don't just forget, you decide to forget, not consciously, but unconsciously. So it's true that the Irish are very preoccupied with forgetting, with remembering, but they're also pretty good at forgetting. And all the work of the feminists in Ireland to recover the lost histories of abuse and institutional neglect over this last decade or two is a very striking story of, you know, the famine may have been remembered forever, ever and ever, but other kinds of, that's a colonial form of colonial abuse, but the abuses of the Catholic Church and of men in Ireland, it's not been so easy to remember. So, and in Britain, of course, people are absolutely excellent at forgetting slavery and empire, totally skilled at it, but very good at remembering the myth of the island story and the way in which Britain has lived alone through, survived alone through the war, will survive alone again through Brexit, etc. So I just wanted to point to the notion of disavowal, which I found extraordinarily helpful in trying to understand racism. Because it's Freud who first talked of the notion, produced the notion of disavowal. And disavowal is about the combination of remembering and forgetting that go at exactly the same moment and which are a product of our split minds and our split consciousness. And Freud talks, just very briefly actually, about the ways in which a disavowal, a denial, is always followed by a remembering. And it's quite extraordinary actually, as I've explored the scale of the disavowal of slave owners in relation to race, their refusal to know about the pain and exploitation and cruelty of the system with which they are completely at home, apparently, how their disavowals of all of that go together with this other side of themselves, the side that is repressed. So disavowal is about knowing and not knowing at the very same moment and is a product of our split minds. And I think that's a helpful way to think about some of these problems. The attempts to break the silence, which again Patrick talks about in the book very movingly, the silences that he's breaking. I thought that his description of himself as the document of the lives of his propertyless parents was very, very powerful evocation actually. How he will do the work of documenting the lives which have left so little in the way of documentation. But those silences, I mean, of course, part of the problem about truth-telling can be that truths are very, very partial and that they don't actually do the work of reconciliation. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, I think, is a classic example of that, that in focusing on questions of perpetrators and victims, what they failed to think about, they individualized the problem, they failed to address the structural problems, which of course have continued to beset South Africa, where we see no reconciliation in the 21st century. So just to close with another wonderful book that I've just read, which is, you can see all these things are running through my head, which is Mamdani's book, Neither Settler Nor Native. And there he argues that if we want reconciliation, and this is as relevant to Ireland as it is to the Caribbean or to South Africa or to any of the places which are rent with conflict, we need to think about all those who have survived as the survivors of the catastrophe, and that what we need to do together is to work together to create a new political order. These are political problems. They're not problems of individual guilt and responsibility. So let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Very insightful discussions. Patrick, is it okay if we come back to you after Madeline speaks. Yes. Madeline, please.
Thank you very much, George. Well, I enormously enjoyed listening to Catherine's response to the book. And it's a great pleasure to respond to Patrick's book, which I absolutely loved. So I'm going to try and explain quite why it was a great, great pleasure over the course of the summer to read it. I'm a writer and not an historian by profession, although I did study history, and my writing is very, very influenced by that degree in history. But I think there's been a sort of long-running frustration that the kinds of history that I absolutely love reading don't manage to really get out often enough beyond the sort of academic world, that a lot of history gets a bit stuck in the academy. And so I am absolutely fascinated by those professional historians who are now experimenting with different forms and what those forms might open up in terms of new audiences. And I think this is where Patrick is doing something that is both very, very brave and hugely admirable. I think the sort of professional historian training has been very, very reserved. And there are still bits of it that creep into the way Patrick writes. I'll come on to one of them in a minute. But this idea that there's somehow some sort of distant objectivity, sort of rationalization, you keep everything at arm's length, you don't talk about your own personal kind of stake and so forth. So I'm absolutely thrilled to see Patrick break loose and to incorporate, you know, trample over these boundaries that we have of genres and pull all those boundaries crashing down. It reminded me of another book that I would pick out as having done a superb job, which was Hazel Carby. I'm sure Catherine is familiar with this, which was the winner of the prize that I was judging last year, the Al Rodin British Academy Prize. So Hazel Carby traced her background through the Caribbean in a superb book called Imperial Intimacies. And in many, many ways, she's covering some of the same ground as Patrick: family history, how we can piece it together through material objects. And it was also an immensely absorbing read. But I wanted to try and explain why I found Patrick's book so immensely exciting, and that is the word I would use. And I think that there is something here about its inspirational quality. And it interests me that Catherine starts by giving us some sort of family background to her own response to the book. I think the book carries a sort of implicit challenge to the reader, which is that by Patrick laying out his family history, this wonderful phrase he just read to us from the introduction about the family is the door, I think he's inviting us all to step over that threshold into our own family histories and the wider social and political histories that they are inevitably entangled in. So like Catherine, I had a very, very personal response to the book, and indeed sent Patrick a long email, which was probably way too long, about my own family history and how it resonated with several parts of Patrick's book. I am a mix of all sorts of diasporas, Jewish, Irish, and Scottish. And all of those diasporic identities seem to me to be immensely important to me. Even though they go back, in some cases, several generations. So the book is inspiring. And I wanted to sort of just tease apart some of the layers of that, because it's an incredibly multi-layered book. There are several different ways to read it. You know, it's almost as if you want the fascinating history, just skip through the book looking at the really interesting historical bits, because it's educational. You learn a lot, and you learn a lot about subjects that you may think you already knew a lot. So, for example, the Second World War, which I've studied a lot, I've written books about the aspects of the Second World War. But the focus that Patrick brings into play about the very specific experience of the bombing campaigns on the German civilian population is, of course, the work of a serious scholar, extensive reading, analysis, careful weighing of the conflicting accounts. It's a deep dive, and it's an absolutely superb piece of work. It's a history that, of course, as Catherine so rightly reminds us, that the British have really absolutely forgotten. I mean, I'm not sure they ever knew it, but it's a history they certainly don't want to know about either. So, you know, the way in which we can try and bring this to a wider understanding, you know, our reading of the Second World War, as Patrick points out, has been so extraordinarily kind of focused on certain British aspects of it. And then what is so thrilling is that one moment you're learning about German bombing, and the next you're learning about the geography of Derry. And again, Patrick is such a trustworthy guide. He writes with such authority and such, it's compelling, such that I'm booking a trip to Derry next summer. I have to see what he's writing about. It's such an extraordinary description. And then, of course, Wedgwood's Potteries in Etruria. I sent a photo of a paragraph to a friend of mine who's planning to write her next book on her family, her hometown of Stoke-on-Trent, and focus particularly on Etruria, Wedgwood's great manufacturing capability. So I like to think that Patrick is spurring and encouraging a whole new set of books, because there's so many kind of beginnings of books, if you like, incorporated in Patrick's. So there's an incredible variety. That this is a book you're never going to get sort of tired of the level of detail. I mean, Patrick it just now talked about the sort of bank of historical detail. Sometimes that can be overwhelming, and historians do develop a type of history which is very much orientated towards each other, the sort of, you know, deep specialism, and which for the outsider, for the non-professional, can feel like a you know, one of those dinner party conversations you don't really understand. But all of this, these very, very different subjects, are not random. They're connected through life experience. And this is the thing that I think was so striking. It's how we live major historical events. The way we write history books, which, you know, historically has been kind of chronological, and it's a specialism, so it takes, you know, one subject, whether it's the Northern Irish Troubles or whether it's the Second World War, it's not actually how it's lived. How it's lived is that we have these different stories going on all the time, and I find that a very powerful way of thinking about history. It is very it's got certain similarities with the way that I wrote my book in 2009, called The Plot, A History of My Father's English Acre. It's a different way of organizing history. What I did in my book was I took an acre of land and traced how human beings had used that land over thousands of years, including how my own father had used the land by building a war memorial chapel. So like Patrick, I was moving from very, very different subject matter. So that included Iron Age burial sites, sheep drovers from Scotland, Cistercians, forestry planting post First World War, and then my father's own family history as to why, you know, a penniless young sculptor decided to put the meagre family resources into building a chapel in the middle of nowhere. And I think that the part of why I love this kind of history, and I think Carby did it as well, Hazel Carby in her book Imperial Intimacies, is it brings history back to life. It reinstates its ongoing place in the present, and in the texture of our lived reality. And so the way history can sort of snag on the heart and tug at the mind, it's the idea that there have been many others in the places before us with comparable sorrows and joys. It's that company of the dead that Catherine and Patrick have both spoken about. And it's a much more alive form of history. than the sort of the kind of history that I studied at Cambridge in the mid 80s, which was a much more kind of documentary process. It was about the record, assembling the record. And to be honest, I found my degree really pretty dull. And it was one of the reasons why I didn't go on into any kind of postgraduate study. And it's a joy now to stumble back into a history which seems so much more vivid and real. What Joyce is doing is more than all of that. It's more even than just vivid history, not that that's a just. He talks about it being part history, part memoir. But actually, there's another dimension to the book, which he could have included in the introduction. And I landed on the word meditation. And then I read Seamus Dean's appreciation of the book. And I realized, ha, he chose the same word. And then I noticed that Terry Eagleton uses another word with very close associations, which was reverential. And I think these choice of words is very revealing, because Eagleton, myself and Joyce, I think, are all former Catholics. I think Eagleton would describe himself as such. Patrick just mentioned the sort of, you know, the Catholicism. So I feel brave enough to keep ploughing into this one. As I say, they're deep waters, but it seems to me that there is a Catholic sensibility which, if you have grown up in Catholicism, does not fade. And you may travel very far away, but it's incredibly persistent. One of the ways Patrick talks about the claims of history which cannot be settled cheaply. And I think that's I would attribute to something of this Catholic sensibility. No cheapness for Patrick. And our labours must be in earnest. There is an accounting for our talents, because they are God-given, and because life has been God-given, and it is indeed, as a practicing Catholic would argue, sacred. And that seriousness that is right at the beginning of Patrick's book, I think it's kind of unfashionable, but to me, it's deeply appealing. It is my world. You know, I take things very, very seriously. And so the kind of unashamed seriousness, it was a pleasure to read. And of course, the first claim of history that he acknowledges is that of his parents. And he uses this other very unfashionable word of homage. And that, again, you know, people don't really talk about homage to their parents. So I would describe Joyce's tone, Patrick's tone here, is of a kind of touching filial piety. And that really does seem to be the appropriate word for the gratitude and respect that is evident on the page. And there's something very humble and humbling about how we witness Patrick's homage, and how that reminds us, actually, about the homage we may need or want to pay to our parents. And I recognize the impulse deeply, because my book was very much a form of homage. I never use the word, but it is a form of homage to my father. And it's something about recognizing how we stand on the shoulders of our forebears. And it's not just our parents, but it's our grandparents and our great-grandparents, and that their tragedies, hardships and joys have shaped our hearts and minds in ways that we can't fully grasp. But we can really hear their lives whispering and echoing through our own. And it's profoundly moving, because it's a very intimate form of company. And I think that's perhaps part of why, as Catherine points out, the popularity of family history is this way of resolving the deep sense of loneliness of modernity. You know, without God, we are lonely. And so family history can fill something of that void. So when Patrick says, I'm not interested in revealing an inner life, though it is true that one cannot altogether avoid the inner in relating the outer, I would suggest to Patrick that this is something of a false note, because by this point, his readers will feel actually that his inner life is on every page of the book. And he may say he's not interested, but I think he is actually. And so are we. And also, given that he acknowledges that all space is political, I'm wondering what the distinction is between inner and outer anyway. So I was getting a bit lost. I can understand the desire for some privacy when writing a personal book, and I completely share that. But perhaps where is he drawing the boundary? And then there is, I have to say, I felt that the women were shadowy. I didn't feel their substance. I questioned why it's my father's house. I come from a tradition of passionate homemakers, women who invest an enormous amount of creative energy in making homes. And he does say that his mother's kitchen was, you know, the center of their life in West London, and the comings and goings of the other members of the Irish community. But why is it my father's house? I mean, obviously historically that's a, you know, convention of patriarchal Catholicism in Ireland, but I would have liked some challenge. And I think Catherine's point about Ireland's terrible, terrible silences about the abuse is a very well-made point, that Catholic patriarchy has been deeply, deeply problematic to the lives of women and children. So to come back to this sort of meditative dimension, the way in which there are big ideas about space and time and key symbols to navigate, it seems to me the book is actually, it's kind of appropriate to use the word spiritual. Patrick is providing a way to think about really powerful, precious, transformative experiences and how they give life rich meaning. And I love the fact that it's reverential, but it also has a righteous anger. You know, Patrick gets very angry in this book, and that seems to me to be a very welcome honesty, which sometimes doesn't appear in a history book. He's angry about Brexit. He's angry about some of the politics of our time. But the reason why meditation fits here is because of the way he shapes silences, how he has attuned his ear through disposition and through scholarship to some of the silences of history as well as the noise. And it's that silence that has space in the book which gives it its depth charge, a sort of powerful poignancy. And it reminded me of the beautiful, beautiful sentence in Middlemarch by George Eliot. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat. And we should die of that roar on the other side of silence. So thank you to Patrick. He put his ear to the silence and heard something of the roar and managed to put it into words and a book. And that is no mean feat. He has ensured that we can hear the silence as well as the roar.
Thank you. Thank you, Madeline, for sharing those insightful reflections, especially how personal life is so entangled in history and how Catholic patriarchy has silenced quite a lot of things, very difficult, tough questions to engage with. We are actually cutting into a bit of our Q&A time. So maybe I would request Patrick take maybe 5 to 6, 7 minutes and possibly respond to Catherine and Madeline. And then later on, when we open up to Q&A, perhaps some of the questions might come from the floor and you would be able to engage with some answers that you want to give now at that time. Is that okay, Patrick?
Yeah, that's fine.
So maybe over to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both, Catherine and Madeline, for that. And I should have thanked you originally, you know, at the start.
Patrick, one more thing. I think there is some background noise coming from your speaker. Is it because of some paper being tumbled?
Yeah, papers, I think.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I've written 3 or 4 pages of notes. That's the trouble. And how can I put them together in 5 minutes? I'd finish saying thank you for agreeing to do this in the first place, and thanks for your wonderful responses. I shall just start talking, and there's so much in what you have to say that reverberates with me and makes me think about questions that I haven't properly answered. Catherine, thank you for the point about disavowal, about the way in which we are split, and the way in which remembering and forgetting are linked. I've never been a devotee of Freud, so I tend to sort of run away. But I shall run towards him then, a little bit anyway. Oh my goodness, these points about history and memory, about living with the dead, about family history. Yes, they're all connected, aren't they? And Madeline's wonderful way of spotting so much of what the book actually is about, which I think chimes with Seamus as well, the late Seamus Dean, whose influence on the book, as we discuss silence together, the silence of Northern Ireland, the silence of murder. How to go into this in some more detail is difficult. It is an act of filial piety, indeed. And I wanted to honour both parents. I'm sorry if you think that my mother's presence is not so marked. I felt she was there in the book. I think I spent as much time talking about her as him. But a lot of that was painful as well. When he died, she had a difficult time. And perhaps I'm also a victim of my age, of my upbringing, which was, okay, Catholic patriarchal, but actually Catholic matriarchal as well. Because when we look at these things, as I've done with peasants, patriarchy, matriarchy, relationships are so complex. But anyway, filial piety, how to get into these things. I'm thinking, for the last 2 years I've been working on peasants. And there, the sense of living with the dead is intrinsic to who they are. I've been very taken up originally with the work of John Berger, who went to live with, and as far as a bourgeois Englishman can do, be a peasant. And I think he wrote better than almost anybody about peasants. He also wrote very movingly about being with the dead. He wrote a wonderful book in which he talks about, he has a series of exchanges with the dead in his life, his mother included. Virgil leads me on to what I've increasingly found in the world of peasants, which is what we've forgotten, which is the sense of life as a kind of circularity in which the dead are part of the living and the living of the dead. In relation to thinking about empire, colonialism, the world in which I was brought up in London, looking at peasants, I've become much more deeply aware that colonialism is intrinsic to all of European history. The colonialism of Eastern Europe. I spent a lot of time looking at the Polish peasantry and about the history of Poland. And I've come increasingly to feel some sense of the connections between the filial piety I feel and the account I'm giving of the culture which we've lost to view almost entirely, especially in Britain, where we from some accounts don't have a peasant class, but actually we did quite a substantial one in the 19th century. But anyway, we've forgotten that past entirely, and I think it's been transformed into heritage in many ways. So in the book, I suppose I'm trying to make contact with a way of looking at time, which is no longer ours, but from which we can learn, from which we can, if we appreciate the relationship between suffering the self-creation of peasants, their capacity to regenerate themselves. They are the class that are survivors. So with them, I feel as if I'm in touch with a kind of, if you like, their life, the elemental structures, the elemental nature of life. So that through this connection to peasants in the writing of this book and to my parents, I feel through a kind of act of filial piety that it's possible to restore a sense of a world we can't any longer live in, but which goes by the name of enchanted or magical, words I don't like, but which I'm trying to get behind in the book I'm doing. So I suppose I'm interested also in the silences, but also in what Seamus refers to as the trace.
Patrick,
just
a second. There is some background noise, background sound coming. Is there any way of, and find difficult to hear?
I can't find any source of the background noise.
Oh, okay. So it must be with the sound system then.
Yeah. Unless I'm making some horrible noise myself.
No. You are not. I think it's some kind of, it's a problem with the sound system. Sorry. But sometimes it's all right, you know?
Yeah. It's what's at the back of silence as well. The way in which once you uncover one silence, you only find another silence, as it were. It reveals an absence. So it's trying to remember, but always trying to remember what we can't remember, what we can't reveal, what's on the other side, the lives of those who were never born, as it were, because of things like famine or the destruction of the peasantry in Eastern Europe. Look, I'm going to leave it there, but there's so many other points that could be raised with the kind of direction thoughts and people's writing is taking towards the family. Catherine puts her finger on some of that. I think probably it's best for me to stop there. And in a sense, I'd like to hear how the thing pans out with other people and get a sense of what my own thoughts are when I confront immediately these two responses to my thought. I'm, as the man said, or the woman said, I'm lost for thought, so I leave it there for the moment. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, now we can hear you. I mean, I'm sorry about the sound that is background, some kind of a disturbance. Now we're going to thank you so much for all your sharings and reflections, Catherine, Madeline, and Patrick. We're going to open up the floor for question and answers, and you can use the chat section. And to tell us also where you, your name and where you're calling from, as you ask your questions. But before we go into the questions, open it to the floor. As a privilege of the chair, I want to ask you a question, Patrick. It also connects to what Catherine and Madeline were saying. And when you speak about the importance, especially drawing on Walter Benjamin's work, you speak about the importance of telling untold stories and paths not taken, because they were silenced because in the name of progress, in the name of tradition and authority, some of these untold stories were silenced, paths were never taken. Now you say when we listen to those, then we have reason to hope, you say. So I was wondering, when we narrate the untold stories, when we talk about the paths not taken, how does that influence our present? How will it influence our future? Especially, Catherine was mentioning about, you also discuss about the need to forget and to forgive, especially if we are going to create a new world. So, but untold stories are going to bring out the stories of the number of the numberless dead, the number of atrocities, especially the atrocities committed by the Catholic Church. Some of those stories will come out in Ireland, or the kind of patriarchal patriarchal dominance. This is all part of the untold stories. So will it lead to reconciliation, or is it forgetting is better so that a much more kind of a reconciled future can be constructed? This was my question as I was reading through the book.
Well, I think my immediate response would be to say that it's always going to be a political question, and it's going to be politics in a particular place. It depends who's doing the forgetting. In Northern Ireland, the politics of forgetting has grave limitations because you forget, and one person's suffering at the cost. You catalogue, remember one person suffering at the cost of forgetting another one. And let me talk briefly about situation in Poland, which is going through my head rather at the moment, which is the question of forgetting the Polish peasants, forgetting peasants themselves, forgetting the atrocities that happened there, which were on an enormous scale. There's a whole generation of younger scholars coming up who want to remember. It depends upon the political balance of power. What the outcomes will be, what the situation will be. Pitted against the nationalists, if you talk about the Catholic Church as being particularly awful in its Catholic patriarchy, its anti-Semitism is profoundly awful. And this has been historically consistent in Poland and throughout much of Eastern Europe. So where do you draw the line? I don't find any particular metaphysical point in drawing the line. It seems to be the particular kind of historical and political conjuncture you're in. In Ireland, in some cases, it can be said that you have to draw the line. The limit has been reached in some sense. In others, the line is always a political line.
Patrick, we have your cousin from Ireland who wants to join. You're going to let her in to the screen.
Indeed, of course, yes.
Yes, yeah. Hello, Anne, please come.
Could I just make a point while we're just waiting?
Yes, please, Catherine.
Well, it's just in response to the exchange between the two of you there, and just to say that, we can never, whatever stories we find about the past can never make the past all right. There's absolutely no way we can do that. So it has to be about what we can do for the present by opening up those stories of the past and by hoping to rewrite histories in a way that makes some kind of political future that between us we might be able to make possible. So I just think, obviously in relation to slavery, the question of reparation is very, very pressing. And there's lots of talk of the money that should be involved and so on and so forth. But money is never going to solve anything, though it might be helpful. And certain investment in the Caribbean would be very, very helpful in terms of health and education and levels of poverty and so on. But a different grasp of the meanings of that in the present to all parties is what we, I think, have to hope for. The point about all this work is not about avenging, it's about trying to live a different life now.
Thanks. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the International Inequalities Institute.
Yes, hi. I'm very happy to be joining in today. I'm in Minnesota right now, and it's about 7:45 in the morning. So, Patrick knows from our previous Zooming together that I always mess something up. For example, I'm wondering if you can see me.
No, we can't see you.
I wonder what I need to do to make you see me.
That's a good question. Saga, anything that we can do?
I don't know. I'm texting with my sister who's in Pittsburgh right now, is saying, how can I get my picture on here? But anyway, I won't waste any time. I have to say just briefly that I just met Patrick within the last year, and we connected him to his cousin, my mother, Bridget. My mother's cousin, or my mother's mother, is Patrick's Aunt Mary. And I would like to say back to the house that for us here in the United States, Patrick's Aunt Mary and two of his uncles emigrated to the United States. His father was the only one of those four children to emigrate to London. But there was some connection there, and we are so pleased and thankful that we were able to reconnect, especially now during this period of history with COVID, et cetera. In reference to the house, Patrick refers to it as my father's house. We refer to it as grandma's house. So I think it's just practical. Maybe we could read something into it. Is it patriarchal? I don't know if it necessarily is. I think we are all connecting to a house, to the walls, to the road that goes below the house, and the graves. I think we are reconnecting in the very same ways. So whether we are saying it's the father's house or the grandmother's house, or as my mother would say, my mother's house, it's not really that important. We are all referring to the same place. We are all referring, and we're all searching for the same answers. Strangely enough, my grandmother didn't talk very much about Ireland. I think it was very painful to her. We have all been there. Most of us of our generation hold both American and Irish citizenship because that is very dear and very important to all of us. And I'm really looking forward to being with Patrick. Hopefully we can be at the house together someday and put some answers to these questions. We're all sharing the book over here on this side of the pond, as they say, and we're all discussing it, believe it or not, even though we are in different locations within the United States. I wanted to say too that I think the book is a sharing among Patrick's relatives right now, and that we are reconnecting, thankfully. My mother is 90. Patrick is not quite that age. I'm going to be 70, and I think we are all looking at this as kind of a rebirth and a reconnection to put some pieces of our family puzzle back together. We had a very strong connection to Ireland. For example, I have pictures of my grandparents in London, and I know that Patrick has a picture in his book proudly wearing little Harry Potter type glasses and a jacket. And I know that that jacket was carried from Pittsburgh by his Aunt Mary to him in London. And it belonged to my Uncle Joseph, my mother's brother. So there are many connections, and we are just so thankful that we were able to connect with Patrick this last year. I just wanted to say too that here in Minnesota, perhaps you're familiar with the IHRC, the Immigration History Resource Center, which is also working on very poignant issues of immigration. When I look at what's going on at the IHRC, and I've done research myself there, most of the research now is on recent immigration. And I think it's very essential for all of us not to only focus on recent immigration. For example, here in the United States, we have it. In Europe, there's a lot of migration going on, as we know. But we have to also keep the past alive. We also have to keep those reconnections going, as Patrick is. And just wanted to say that there's been a shared gratitude, and for our grandparents' generosity, I think Patrick is thankful for what his parents have done for him in life. And I would like to say that all of us here in the United States are always aware of what our grandparents have done when they left home, meaning when they left Ireland and came bravely to the United States. It wasn't easy. They lived in great poverty here in the United States. I think sometimes too, that people think that, oh, when people go to America, they have it made. It takes two or three generations for the children of immigrants to finally have made it, so to say. My grandparents, Patrick's aunt, for example, his Aunt Mary, were not wealthy people. They were very poor. They didn't own a house until they were almost retired. They rented a house and they always sent money home to Ireland, always. It was a priority to them to keep that connection alive and to help those who stayed at home. But anyway, we could go on for hours and days and months and years talking about this, but I just want to say that it's a joy to listen to Patrick's book today. It's a joy to listen to all of your comments. I'm like Patrick in that I have 5 pages of notes. How many pages do you have, Patrick, so far?
Oh, 6.
Okay. Well, I have 5.5 because I ran out of paper and I'm doing it on a half. But anyway, I am planning to connect with Patrick in person. I think a lot of us are, once we can travel a little more freely and catch up with what the last year has done to all of us. But just want to say what a joy it is to be listening and sharing and learning so much from this presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, for joining us and sharing your experiences and your thoughts on immigration. We really appreciate your presence here.
Thank you. I wish you could see my mug, but I can't figure out how to put my face on the screen.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Thank you.
Patrick knows what I look like. In fact, I sent you an email last week and some pictures, Patrick. So when you have time to look at the old email, they're on there for you.
Okay. Thank you. We don't have much time now, only 5 minutes left, and we have 2 questions. One is from Mike. And before Mike, we come to Mike, I also have a question from Canada, from Stella Lord. My husband has Joyce relatives in Australia, and their family history is complex, interesting, and somewhat disturbing. We are considering a visit to Ireland next year, and I would be interested to know where is Joyce's country in Ireland. Thanks, Stella. That's good. Definitely. Now I'm going to Mike. Mike wants to appreciate. Thanks, Pat, Catherine, Madeline, for this wonderful discussion. You're famous, Pat, for promoting Foucauldian approaches to social history in the 90s, the 1990s and 2000s. And I would, and I wonder how you would see this body of theory now in the light of your more personal and elegiac account here. Are there resonances with the Foucault, for example, around the confessional, or do you think you are now working in a different register? So the question is about, are you moving away from Foucauldian to more personal? How?
Yeah, of course I am. For me, Foucault is always an extraordinary powerful, appeal, a fantastically interesting man and intellectual. But I was always trying to do things with Foucault, and there are certain things you can't do with Foucault. And it's one of the things I think right in the way I have. He wrote about peasants, of course, but that book is a very different kind of book. The question of power is, of course, intrinsic to all of this. And it could be said that in going to my father's house, it's an absence. And that's a kind of regret I have. I say somewhere in the book that our lives were continuously governed by all sorts of schemes that we were hardly aware of, the infrastructure around us, the gas meter, for instance, which was an extraordinary regulator of working class incomes and a source of considerable working class income itself when you priced it open and got the pennies out. I've been trying to think about how the question of power, Foucault can still help me very much, I think, in terms of the kinds of the infrastructural, the underground nature of power, the way in which in the present book, power operates through the whole system of Catholicism, through the workings of the manor, through the coming of electricity, etc., etc., etc.
Okay, then for me, it's been a pleasure for me to chair this event today. Thank you very much to all the panelists, Patrick, Catherine, and Madeline, and everybody who assisted us with the interpretation and all that. So if you would like to know more about the activities of LSE-III, please follow the link in the chat to sign up for the fortnightly newsletter and learn more about our work. So until we meet again, virtually or otherwise, thank you and goodbye. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks so much.